Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Journalists in Ukraine have been targeted and continue to face unprecedented dangers carrying out their work in the wake of the Russian invasion, top independent rights experts said on Wednesday. The alert from UN-appointed independent rights experts cited numerous reports that journalists have been targeted, tortured, kidnapped, attacked and killed, or refused safe passage from cities and regions under siege. Latest UN data indicates that 7 journalists have been confirmed killed in Ukraine since the Russian invasion on the 24th of February. The last time so many media professionals lost their lives in Ukraine was in 2014, when Russia annexed Crimea. They also rejected the European Union's recent decision to ban 2 Russian media companies as disproportionate, adding that this move had been used as a pretext for the additional closure of independent media outlets in Russia. Promoting access to diverse and verifiable information, including ensuring access to free, independent and pluralistic media, is a more effective response to disinformation, they said. They called on Russia to fully implement its international human rights obligations, including by respecting, promoting and protecting the freedom to seek, receive and impart information, and by ensuring a safe working environment for independent media, journalists and civil society groups. Staying with Ukraine, as latest data showed that more than 5.6 million people have now fled the country since the war started, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has launched a music campaign to promote solidarity with displaced people everywhere. Together with TikTok and music legend Dionne Warwick, UNHCR is calling for safe and legal access to asylum for all, backed up by live concerts from artists all over the world that will be shared online. Ms. Warwick's song, What the World Needs Now, provided the inspiration behind the campaign's name and renews a historic partnership with the singer that goes back to 1968. At that time, there were fewer than 4 million refugees, but today there are well over 85 million displaced globally. There has never been a more important time to stand in solidarity and show support for people around the world who've been forced to flee from their homes, Ms. Warwick said. As new data from the World Health Organization indicated that Europe is in the grip of a worsening obesity epidemic, UN workers on the other side of the world have highlighted solutions to unhealthy diets in Fiji. According to the UN Health Agency, nearly 2/3 of adults and almost 1 in 3 children are either overweight or obese in Europe. Estimates suggest that these conditions cause more than 1.2 million deaths annually, while obesity alone also increases the risk of developing more than a dozen cancers, cardiovascular diseases, and type 2 diabetes. In Fiji, where unhealthy eating is also responsible for a growing number of non-communicable diseases, an innovative smartphone app is already helping thousands of Fijians to eat better. The free app, whose name MyKanu translates as food in Fiji's indigenous Itake language, helps users to calculate how nutritious what they're eating is and how many calories it contains. The app, which has been developed by the Fijian Health Ministry along with the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, also encourages people to grow their own food. With sufficient funding, the aim is to customize it to at least 12 other Pacific Island nations. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Do we stop ourselves sleepwalking into another Great Depression? It's breathtaking, you know, for folks that are listening to this. I don't know if they realise the extent of the tax injustice issue, that you've got these major corporations and rich people that go offshore with the money. People get away with it.
World leaders meet and they discuss the big issues, inequality, climate crisis, but the whole thing is a charade.
I think prison should be very real for accounting professionals who advise on aggressive tax avoidance schemes, without a doubt.
What we know about how the mainstream media reported on the financial crisis is that the deeper structural problems with the banking sector weren't really covered.
The majority of the public now understand that there is an emergency. People need to know that there's something that can be done.
There is a new dawn which is happening. The resistance is coming from the old guard.
This opens up a crucial debate about how humankind wants to develop over the course of the coming century.
Join me, Naomi Fowler, and John Christensen for the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We talk about how we take back control from the super rich and powerful and make our economies work for all of us. You can find us on most podcast apps, and your favourite radio station can broadcast us for free. Get more information on us on www.taxjustice.net/taxcast. See you there.
Yes, Naomi will be up at the top of the second hour following Law and Disorder.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have the most important question facing us. What can be done against the crimes of aggression and other international war crimes that we see unfolding before our eyes right now? We have Marjorie Cohen to speak with us. Marjorie, what are you going to talk about?
Michael, I'm going to talk about the possible commission of the crime of aggression, war crimes, and crimes against humanity by Russia and in some instances by Ukraine, and whether or not the International Criminal Court has jurisdiction to prosecute those crimes.
We take a look at the use of the necessity defense to curb and control climate change.
We speak with attorney Ted Hamilton, who's recently had published his book, Beyond Fossil Law, Climate Courts, and the Fight for a Sustainable Future.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
As the war in Ukraine continues to rage, the U.S. Senate passed a resolution that, quote, encourages member states to petition the International Criminal Court or other appropriate international tribunals to take any appropriate steps to investigate war crimes and crimes against humanity committed by the Russian armed forces, close quote. Yet the United States has consistently undermined the ICC. The U.S. government thinks the ICC is reliable enough to try Russians, but not U.S. or Israeli officials. Today on Law and Disorder, we will examine the matter of what constitutes a war crime, whether war crimes have been committed by either side in Russia and the Ukraine, and the role of the International Criminal Court in adjudicating whether or not war crimes have in fact been committed. Our guest today is co-host on Law and Disorder, Marjorie Cohn, who is a professor emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law. She's the former president of the National Lawyers Guild. She's a member of the Advisory Board of Veterans for Peace and the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. Marjorie Cohn writes a regular column on Truthout and provides frequent legal and political commentary for local, national, and international media. Her books include Drones and the Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Marjorie Cohn, welcome back to Law and Disorder, and this time on the side of a guest. Thank you for being here, Marjorie. Which is against Russia for its conduct of the war in the Ukraine. Before we get into the matter of what war crimes may actually have been committed in the Ukraine, is the United States a party to the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court?
The answer is no. As Bill Clinton was leaving office, he put the U.S. signature on the Rome Statute for the ICC. Now, the difference between signing and ratifying a treaty is that when a country signs a treaty, that indicates an intent to ratify. Once two-thirds of the Senate in the United States give its advice and consent to ratification, then the president ratifies a treaty and then the U.S. becomes a party to that treaty. Now, as Clinton was leaving office, he advised the incoming President George W. Bush not to send the Rome Statute to the Senate for advice and consent to ratification. So Bush enters office, and not only did he refrain from sending the Rome Statute to the Senate, he unsigned the Rome Statute. It was unprecedented, actually removed the U.S. signature from the Rome Statute. So the answer once again is no, the U.S. is not a party to the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court.
Professor Cohn, you recently wrote an article on truthdig.org entitled, After Undermining International Criminal Court, U.S. Now Wants It to Charge Russians. In what ways has the United States tried to undermine the ICC over the years?
Well, shortly after Bush unsigned the Rome Statute, Congress passed what was called the American Service Members Protection Act, which contains a clause called the Hague Invasion Act, and it says that if a U.S. or allied national is detained by the ICC, the U.S. military can use armed force to extricate them. Now, although the U.S. is not a party to the Rome Statute, it has nevertheless tried to influence the direction of the court. And the Bush administration effectively blackmailed 100 countries, developing democracies with weak economies, 100 countries that were parties to the Rome Statute, by forcing them to sign bilateral immunity agreements in which they promised not to turn over U.S. persons to the ICC or, and this is the blackmail, the United States would withhold foreign aid from them. In 2020, the ICC launched an investigation into possible war crimes and crimes against humanity by the United States as well as Taliban leaders in Afghanistan. The Trump administration imposed sanctions on ICC officials, which Biden later reversed. But when a new chief prosecutor came into the ICC, he narrowed the scope of the Afghanistan investigation by limiting suspects to Taliban and ISIS leaders, citing limited resources. But this was clearly a political decision. And there are victims of U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan who will now not receive justice from the ICC. Torture by the CIA in the brutal Bagram prison and civilians killed in U.S. drone strikes in Afghanistan. And Biden has expressed serious concerns about the ICC's attempts to exercise its jurisdiction over Israeli personnel. So it's the ICC is good enough to try Russians, but not U.S. or Israeli leaders. Well, back to the Israeli investigation into Israeli war crimes and Palestinian war crimes as well, but primarily Israeli war crimes in the ICC. After a five-year preliminary examination, the former ICC chief prosecutor found a reasonable basis to mount an investigation of the situation in Palestine, and she was satisfied that war crimes were being committed in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. And she initiated her preliminary examination 6 months after Israel's 2014 so-called Operation Protective Edge, in which Israeli military forces killed 2,200 Palestinians, nearly one quarter of them children, and more than 80% civilians. And Michael, there is incredible U.S. hypocrisy in this resolution that was unanimously passed by the Senate, and you know senators can't agree on anything these days, but all 100 senators agreed to the resolution trying to get the ICC to try Russians for war crimes. And in the second paragraph of that resolution, it says, and I quote, "Whereas the United States of America is a beacon for the values of freedom, democracy, and human rights across the globe, .. This, Michael, in spite of the U.S. wars of aggression in Kosovo, Iraq, Afghanistan, and other countries, and the commission of U.S. war crimes, many of which were revealed by Julian Assange and WikiLeaks in 2010, which is why Julian Assange is now facing 175 years in prison if he's extradited from the U.K. But if these U.S. senators truly believed that the ICC is dependable enough to prosecute Russian leaders, they should push Biden to send the Rome Statute to them for advice and consent to ratification, because what's good for the Russian goose should also be good for the U.S. gander.
Amen. Hypocrisy really is not a strong enough word here, Marjorie. Before we look at what acts during the war in Ukraine could be considered war crimes, cannot the very act of invading another country and waging war there itself be considered a crime? Could the ICC punish Russian leaders for the crime of aggression?
Well, in 1946, the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg called the waging of aggressive war essentially an evil thing, and they said to initiate a war of aggression is not only an international crime, it is the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson, who took a leave from the court to serve as chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg Tribunal, called aggressive war the greatest menace of our times. And Jackson said, if certain acts in violation of treaties are crimes, they are crimes whether the United States does them or whether Germany does them, and we are not prepared to lay down a rule of criminal conduct against others which we would not be willing to have invoked against us. Aggression is prohibited by the ICC's Rome Statute. The crime of aggression is defined as the planning, preparation, initiation, or execution by a person in a position effectively to exercise control over or to direct the political or military action of a state of an act of aggression which, by its character, gravity, and scale, constitutes a manifest violation of the Charter of the United Nations. Now, adopting the central prohibition of the UN Charter against the use of aggressive force, the Rome Statute defines an act of aggression as the use of armed force by a state against the sovereignty, territorial integrity, or political independence of another state, or in any other manner inconsistent with the Charter of the United Nations. The UN Charter only allows the use of military force when conducted in self-defense after an armed attack or with the consent of the Security Council, neither of which happened before Russia invaded Ukraine. Now, the jurisdictional scheme for the ICC, and by the way, the ICC, the Rome Statute, punishes for the four most atrocious crimes in the world, war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and the crime of aggression. And the original Rome Statute said that genocide, war crimes, and crimes of aggression could be prosecuted in the ICC if, number one, the defendant's country was a party to the Rome Statute, or number two, one or more elements of the crime was committed in the territory of a state that's a party to the Rome Statute, or three, the defendant's country accepted ICC jurisdiction for the matter, or four, upon referral by the UN Security Council. But the Rome Statute left the definition and jurisdictional scheme for prosecuting the crime of aggression to the future. And finally, there was an agreement to prosecute the crime of aggression, and I just read you the definition of the crime of aggression, which is contained in amendments to the Rome Statute. But the way it's been interpreted is that in order to come under the jurisdiction of the ICC for a crime of aggression, a leader, in this case we're talking a Russian leader, would have to, the country of Russia would have to actually adopt, or Ukraine, would have to actually adopt these amendments defining aggression, and neither Russia nor Ukraine has done that. Now, Ukraine has accepted jurisdiction of the ICC for purposes of war crimes and crimes against humanity, but has not ratified these aggression amendments. So that's the long answer to your question. The short answer is that the ICC does punish the crime of aggression, but no, it cannot punish Russian leaders for the crime of aggression, although it could punish them and Ukrainians as well for war crimes and crimes against humanity.
We're talking with our own Marjorie Cohn, Professor Emerita of Law at Thomas Jefferson University in San Diego. Marjorie, of all the people that we might have had, we have you as our co-host who actually knows quite a lot about this. So we're so pleased to have you on Law and Disorder. Marjorie, could you please outline for us any acts committed by Russia and or Ukraine that may constitute war crimes or crimes against humanity?
Yes, Michael. First, I want to say that Karim Khan, who's the chief prosecutor of the ICC, opened an investigation into the situation in Ukraine, and his preliminary examination found a reasonable basis to believe that alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity had been committed in Ukraine, and he said his investigation will encompass any new alleged crimes that are committed by any party to the conflict. That includes Ukrainian leaders as well. And on the 22nd of April, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said that there were accusations of war crimes against both sides and that they had verified 5,264 civilian casualties, including 2,345 deaths since the war began on February 24th. And 92.3% of them were recorded in Ukrainian government-controlled territory. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Office said in a statement, and I quote, "Russian armed forces have indiscriminately shelled and bombed populated areas, killing civilians and wrecking hospitals, schools, and other civilian infrastructure, actions that may amount to war crimes." And they also said that they documented what appears to be the use of weapons with indiscriminate effects, causing civilian casualties and damage to civilian objects by Ukrainian armed forces in the east of the country. There have also been extensive reports that some women were raped before being killed by Russian forces, and once again, rape constitutes torture, which constitutes a war crime. In terms of the environmental war crime, Russia's seizure of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster site mobilized radioactive dust and increased detectable radiation that could spread radioactive material into new areas. And attacks against some cities caused major fires in fuel storage areas, threatening serious air, ground, and water pollution. Now, in terms of crimes against humanity, which are defined as taking place in the context of a large-scale attack targeting civilians, crimes against humanity include torture, persecution of an identifiable group, and other inhumane acts, intentionally causing great suffering or serious injury to body or mental or physical health. The New York Times reported on April the 19th that the Ukrainian government was using cluster bombs, which is a class of weapons that include rockets, bombs, missiles, mortar, and artillery shells that split open midair and dispense smaller bomblets over a wide area. And sometimes they don't explode, so children and other people can step on them and then they explode and kill or maim them. The Convention on Cluster Munitions bans them because of the indiscriminate harm that they can cause for civilians. Now, neither the U.S., Ukraine, nor Russia have signed that convention, but nevertheless, it is possible that the use of cluster bombs could constitute a crime against humanity.
Does the ICC have the power or the authority to arrest alleged war criminals? And how effective has the ICC been in prosecuting accused war criminals? And how long does the process take from when the charges are brought to the conclusion of the case?
The answer is yes, the ICC does have the power to arrest alleged war criminals. Now, they have to first find them and get jurisdiction over them, and that is not an easy feat. The ICC has primarily prosecuted leaders of African countries, and it has come under criticism for that, although, as I said, there is a formal investigation now pending in the ICC against now Taliban and ISIS leaders for crimes in Afghanistan, as well as Israeli leaders, as well as Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories. Since 2002, when the Rome Statute became effective, there have been only 10 convictions, and again, mostly African leaders. And the process is a very long one. It takes years from the initial preliminary examination to the formal investigation to subpoenas, arrests, trial, and ultimately sentencing.
Led by the USA and other NATO nations, the Western world has imposed on Russia what many believe to be the harshest set of sanctions ever imposed on a country. But are sanctions lawful?
Well, Michael, the United States has also imposed sanctions on Cuba since 1959-1960, an embargo which has now become a blockade, which has put tremendous economic and political pressure on Cuba and Cubans and punishes other countries for trading with Cuba. The U.S. has imposed punishing sanctions on Venezuela, Nicaragua, and a number of other countries. And the United States and other NATO countries have indeed imposed grueling sanctions against Russia, most of which actually harm the Russian people, and not just the Russian people, but people around the world, including people in the United States. And we can see that reflected in the very high gas prices we find when we go to the pump. Now, the answer to your question is no, sanctions are not lawful. They are unilateral coercive measures, and they violate the UN Charter because under the Charter, only the UN Security Council has the authority to order the use of sanctions. And that means that the United States and other countries cannot unilaterally impose sanctions against other countries without the approval of the Security Council. Article 41 of the UN Charter says the Security Council may decide what measures not involving the use of armed force are to be employed to give effect to its decisions, and it may call upon the members of the United Nations to apply such measures. These may include complete or partial interruption of economic relations and of rail, sea, air, postal, telegraphic, radio, and other means of communication, and the severance of diplomatic relations. So whereas the corporate media is rife with reports about sanctions, you know, screaming for harsher sanctions against Russia, these unilateral coercive measures imposed against Russia by the United States and other NATO countries violate the UN Charter.
Marjorie Cohen, we only have a few more minutes till we run out of our allotted time, unfortunately. But before I ask you a final question, can you tell us where listeners can read your frequent online posts? And do you have a website you'd like to refer our listeners to?
Yes. I write a regular column on truthout.org, and my column is called Human Rights and Global Wrongs. That comes out 3 or 4 times a month. And all of my articles, videos, interviews, radio interviews, books, etc., are collected at my website, which is marjoriecohen.com.
Marjorie, final question. I read in the New York Times that Biden has pledged to give another $34 billion in arms to the Ukraine. It really is a proxy war. We can understand the circumstances which drove Russia to invade the Ukraine. We certainly can't condone them. And now, with the United States, it seems, looking to overthrow the government of Russia and fighting Russia in this proxy war to every last drop of Ukrainian blood. What do you see the dangers are of escalation, even to the point of nuclear arms?
Well, there is a real danger of nuclear war. Unfortunately, Russia has threatened to use nuclear weapons, and indeed there are NATO countries surrounding Russia. The U.S. has a military base 100 miles from the Russian border in Poland, a new base about to open this year, which likely has nuclear weapons. So the U.S. and other NATO countries are playing with fire. And the reason that Russia is so intent on Ukraine not becoming a member of NATO, because when the Soviet Union was breaking up, the U.S. government promised that former Soviet bloc countries and Warsaw Pact countries would not become members of NATO. Ukraine is right on the Russian border, and if Ukraine was a member of NATO, then under Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty, the founding document of NATO, all NATO countries would have to use military force to defend Ukraine, which means that we would already be in a hot war with U.S. troops and other NATO country troops in Russia and possibly even a nuclear war. So it's very, very dangerous, and just adding fuel to the fire. The United States and other NATO countries should be pursuing a diplomatic solution and should be working hard to broker that, but unfortunately, they're spending more time arming Ukraine to the teeth, and of course, U.S. defense contractors are getting rich off of it.
Thank you very much, Marjorie Cohn, for being with us on Law and Disorder. This is about the most important thing that's going on in the world, and we pledge to our listeners that we'll continue coverage of this war. Thank you again, Marjorie. We really appreciate your preparation and the fine way that you've articulated the situation here. You take it easy.
Thanks so much, Michael. You too.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The technology exists to halt and reverse the ongoing catastrophe of climate change. What is lacking is the political will to do so. It is legal in the United States to put millions of tons of poison into the air, but it is illegal to disrupt this ecocide. Our courts and Congress defend this ecocide. What is to be done? In 2016, four people, known as the Valve Turners, shut down four pipelines in the states of Washington, Montana, Minnesota, and North Dakota. They were arrested and tried. How did the Valve Turners defend themselves? They mounted the defense of necessity. The necessity defense is the legal concept that a person can commit a minor crime in order to prevent a larger one. In this case, the Valve Turners admitted to trespass on oil pipeline company property in order to prevent their ongoing contribution to the crisis of climate change. We speak today with attorney Ted Hamilton, author of the just published book, Beyond Fossil Law, Climate Courts and the Fight for a Sustainable Future. Bill McKibbins described Ted Hamilton's book as a, quote, sweeping account of how the legal system enables the ongoing destruction of the planet, end quote. Ted Hamilton is a climate movement lawyer, writer, and literary scholar. After law school, he co-founded the Climate Defense Project, which provides legal assistance to climate justice activists, including the Valve Turners. He lives in Worcester, Massachusetts. Ted Hamilton, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Ted, tell us just how bad is the climate crisis, and how long do we have to drastically change fossil law?
So the fossil law system has been in place for a long time. We don't have much time to replace it because the climate crisis is very, very serious. It's ongoing. It's not something that's going to happen in the future. It's going to continue to get worse the longer we continue to pump CO2 into the atmosphere. You can look at scientific reports about how long we have to do that, whether it's stop extracting by 2030 or be net zero by 2050. But I think the most important point is that we're already in the middle of this crisis, and it's fundamentally a justice question because this is being done with full consciousness of the crisis to people who have not very seriously contributed to the problem. So that crisis of justice already exists, which means we've got to start dismantling fossil law now. And rather than identifying a deadline or an endpoint, I think we need to understand that this is already bad. It's already around us, and we've got to do this work as quickly as we possibly can.
Yeah, you know, Ted Hamilton, I just came across a report, which I'd hoped to have in front of me as we were talking today, by a number of world scientists who work on the climate question, saying that of the kind of 12 generally accepted quote-unquote tipping points we have talked about over the decades now, at least 9 of them have been passed already, so you're quite right to be crying the alarm on this. But I also wonder, and if you could tell our audience, how and why you got involved with these wonderful four folks in the Valve Turners.
I got involved with their case just shortly out of law school. I'd known some of the Valve Turners through climate activism while I was a law student in the Boston area. And I started a nonprofit with two fellow law students as soon as we graduated, Alex Markhart and Kelsey Skaggs. And what we wanted to do was defend climate activists and use our law licenses to try to dismantle fossil law and put forward new theories for achieving climate justice. And very shortly after we started that organization, the Valve Turners took this action, this courageous action. And so we were already in touch with some of them, and they called us up and asked us to be a part of their legal team. So really in the days and weeks immediately following what they did in October 2016, ourselves with Climate Defense Project, along with Civil Liberties Defense Center and Lauren Regan, and another group of lawyers, got a legal team assembled on the fly, and we basically hit the ground running to try to advance their direct action into courtroom legal activism.
Ted, every government in the world has acknowledged that the tar sands oil that's coming down from Canada, this filthy oil, must be eliminated as quickly as possible. So how do you understand and appreciate the Valve Turners' actions?
Well, as we mentioned at the top, there's scientific consensus that things like tar sands oil can no longer be used. We're already past the point where it makes any sense at all to be pumping these fuels into the atmosphere. Tar sands oil is particularly polluting. It's particularly bad for the atmosphere. So we have that knowledge, and yet government and corporations continue to put this stuff into the air. They fail to do anything about preventing this type of pollution. And in the absence of those powers taking responsibility and doing something, our only option is for activists and regular people to take this action. So we know what needs to be done. Nobody's doing it. I think it's pretty simple to see that we need people like the Valve Turners to do it themselves.
Yeah, Ted Hamilton, I don't practice law any longer, but I'm an attorney by training and education and what have you, and I was very impressed with the defense here that was put together. Why did you and the Valve Turners argue that it was necessary, not simply, useful or strategic, but necessary for them to take matters into their own hands, as I did? A necessity defense, if you will.
So this necessity defense has existed for a long time. It's not always used in political context. It's the idea that the legal system, laws, can't accurately predict any type of situation where somebody's is going to need to act in the public good. And so we have to have a mechanism to allow people to violate the letter of the law in order to do something that benefits society. We're standing on the shoulders of a lot of great legal giants here who have developed this defense for political defendants, especially in the 1970s and 1980s. It had started to be used in the climate justice movement towards the end of the 2000s, early 2010s, so it was kind of out there in the air. These Valve Turners were very savvy about legal activism. They knew this was a potential option. And again, them looking at the tar sands problem, they knew that somebody needed to directly intervene, not only to try to actually shut off tar sands emissions, they actually shut off those pipelines that day, but to inspire and grow a movement to take this kind of direct action as well. If you study social history, American history, you know that often the government is not going to be pushed to do something in the interest of the people unless the people take the first step. So that was their theory of change. That's why it was necessary on multiple levels. And what we decided to do was to argue that there were no good legal alternatives to this. There was no government action that they could possibly pursue to turn off these pipelines. Facing such a great hazard as the use of tar sands oil in a climate catastrophe, going on to corporate property to shut off these pipelines, and they did do it in a very safe manner, as testimony at trial revealed, no risk of a spill. They did everything the way the company would have done it to shut off these valves themselves. Doing that and trespassing is a really very minor harm compared to the drastic harm that was still ongoing in the absence of such action. So that's how they argued that this was necessary for them to do it, and it fit quite nicely within the common law of necessity, the necessity defense that other activists have used in the past to justify this kind of direct action when the government isn't doing anything.
We're talking with attorney Ted Hamilton, who just out of law school formed the Climate Defense Project, and they did some real good. We're going to get into how they won one of their cases. But I wanted to remind listeners that Ted is the author of the just-published book, Beyond Fossil Law, Climate Courts and the Fight for a Sustainable Future. It's a brilliant book, just beautifully written. Or Books, that's O-R, Or Books, orbooks.com, put it out. And I would recommend anybody that really wants to understand what we can do to try to tackle this crisis should get this book, Beyond Fossil Law, by Ted Hamilton. In one of the trials, the judiciary recognized the climate necessity defense. To what extent was this successful, and can this be used going forward?
So maybe it's important to look at all four different trials that happened over the course of the Valve Turner's encounter with the legal system. Their actions took place in four different states. Initially, when the lawyers and the defendants tried to offer climate necessity defense, the first kind of reactions we got from judges were that this was an absurd theory. There's always something else you can do besides civil disobedience to address a problem like this. Go sign another petition, lobby Congress. You got plenty of time. We even had a judge in Washington State say from the bench that climate change is a matter of great controversy. A lot of people think it's not real. And he wasn't going to host the Scopes Monkey trial of global warming. That wasn't within his purview. And we got the state appellate court and then ultimately the state Supreme Court to allow that theory of climate necessity to go forward. Interestingly, what happened there, and this might be of interest to practicing attorneys out there, once we got judicial approval of this necessity defense, the judge actually found, before that whole defense theory was put forward, that the state couldn't even support its criminal charges. They were arguing that the defendants had damaged the pipeline, and they never did that. And so those charges were tossed out. Later in Washington, we appealed what that first trial judge had said about the controversial nature of global warming. And as we appealed up to the appellate court there, we also got a judicial recognition of the climate necessity defense. Now we've got a situation in Washington and Minnesota where high courts have put a stamp of approval on the theory. And that has now been picked up by and used by other activists beyond the Valve Turners. We've seen a successful case in Oregon. We've seen a case in Washington proceed under this theory. Just a few weeks ago in Pennsylvania, a group of activists successfully used the climate necessity defense. So within a few short years, and this is what I describe in the book, we went from a judicial approach to this theory as being kind of absurd and out there to now being written into the law, at least in a couple states. We can start to cite that. People can start to use that in different states. And what we hope to see is kind of a propagation of this theory that can be used by defendants. We're not saying it's always going to be successful, but we've at least broken that wall that allows people to start arguing it and build a body of law from which, you know, to go forward and make this theory, make this argument around other types of civil disobedience.
And let me tell you, audience, I don't know if you're not a lawyer, perhaps you can't fully appreciate not only the brilliance of bringing this in the first place, but the victory that has been achieved and what that might mean going forward for the efforts to try to halt and reverse, if possible, climate change. This is a profound benefit to the movement around climate change, what you're listening to.
I think what the courts and the law hate is that a jury would be able to decide something against a corporation. And I think that they hate the fact that people know, a lot of people out there know, that something's wrong with the climate. And to be able to bring this evidence to a jury and to be able to have a jury do something that's going to affect a corporation is a tremendous breakthrough.
It really is. That poor judge who wants to talk about the controversy about climate change is way behind the majority of people now in this country, thankfully. But I wonder, Ted, speaking of the courts and speaking of the legal system, what do we need to know to fully understand the legal system's contribution to the rise of carbon emissions and the suffering and injustices that these emissions produce. Talk to us a bit about that.
One way to think about this is that there is a legal infrastructure that's parallel to the physical infrastructure of the fossil fuel system. So we've got pipelines and refineries and oil wells all around us. There's also a lot of legal rules, regulations, principles that support the continued use of fossil fuels. That ranges from direct government support of the industry. We still subsidize the extraction and use of fossil fuels in the United States. We lease fossil fuel extraction on federal land. So it's directly promoted by a whole suite of legal policies. But then we've also got a gigantic apparatus that protects the fossil fuel industry from any type of attack or any type of attempt to prevent them from damaging the world's atmosphere. So whether those are private property rights that protect their profits, protect their use of fossil fuel facilities, or whether that's various rules of process and standing, and we can get into some detail on those points if you like, but there are a whole bunch of ideas and concepts baked into our legal system that make it extremely difficult to argue that what they're doing is wrong or what they're doing is illegal. And just to take an example, Chief Justice Roberts in Massachusetts versus EPA, which is a major climate change case in 2007, he was in the dissent there. He didn't win, but he argued that climate change is such a global problem, its effects last for so many decades and centuries, that it's really not appropriate for a U.S. federal court to allow anyone to argue that they've been harmed by this, that their harm is distinct from anyone else's, or that there's really any defendant who should be responsible. It's something we're all involved in, is kind of the idea. Now, Justice Roberts' philosophy is probably more in the ascendance with the arch-conservative Supreme Court supermajority, and I think that kind of indicates the kind of philosophy and approach to this problem that really sees interference with the fossil fuel system as illegitimate.
Speaking about, indeed, how the corporations and governments are building new apparatuses of legal control and such, certainly they're fighting back to the kinds of decisions you won with the valve turners. But we lose sight of how indigenous communities in particular are bearing the brunt very often of this state violence. Talk to us a bit about that, and isn't that somewhat of an answer to what Roberts was arguing as well?
So this is a really important point, and I think it reveals a couple things for us. Number one, that the fossil fuel system is deeply implicated with colonialism and with how this country was settled, with settler colonialism. This is not something from the history books. We're still seeing fossil fuel companies, with the aid of the government, invading indigenous territory in order to extract these fossil fuels. Another thing that this continued practice of invasion and violation of indigenous rights, the other thing that reveals is that part of fossil law, part of the legal apparatus that promotes the use of fossil fuels, is the use of the criminal legal system, the use of police and prosecutors to suppress dissent and prevent people from interfering with this system. And so at places like Standing Rock or the fight over the Line 3 pipeline in Minnesota, where the Ojibwe people are located, you see the government, in conjunction with corporations, going onto these lands and asserting the property rights of corporations to build pipelines and extract oil from those areas, regardless of the risk. There's a lot of legal issues involved there. I mean, these are violations of treaty rights. There are violations of environmental protections and cultural protections, but we really can't totally understand how the government actually works with corporations without understanding that those are often the focal point, the front line of the climate justice fight, because those are some of the last remaining places we can find new fossil fuels. If we flip that around, we can also see indigenous communities acting as a vanguard for climate justice, acting as a vanguard for legal fights against the fossil fuel system, and they've done a lot of the most important work in articulating different sorts of legal ideas, different sorts of legal defenses to push back on fossil law.
We're speaking with Ted Hamilton, who's written the just-published book, Beyond Fossil Law, Climate Courts and the Fight for a Sustainable Future. It's published by OR Books, that's OR Books, LawAndDisorder.com. And Ted, I want to tell you, I thought that the chapter where you write about what they've done on indigenous land and what they've done to these people and how the indigenous people have fought back was one of the most beautifully written chapters in your book, and I congratulate you on that. But I wanted to ask you, Ted, what concepts of environmental rights and stewardship hold the promise of abolishing fossil law? Talk about the development of public trust doctrine and the rights of nature as climate law of the future, please.
Public trust doctrine and rights of nature are both good examples of what we might think of as climate justice law, what might replace fossil law. They are ideas that would not only give us really good environmental outcomes, but also could help us to shift our thinking about the relationship between people and their environment, and the need for the legal system to take a much more comprehensive view of how we affect biodiversity, affect other species, and the obligations that we hold for future generations. All of which, those ideas, are pretty hard for our currently existing legal system to acknowledge, let alone address in any substantive way. So the public trust doctrine, again, a pretty ancient legal idea dating back to the Byzantine Empire, at least, the notion that a sovereign, a government, has a responsibility to protect natural resources. Things like water, things like the air, should be held in common for the use of everyone today and everybody in the future. Basically, the public trust doctrine is the reason why nobody can buy the Mississippi River, or you can't buy Lake Michigan. We have this deep-seated assumption that those things are for the public use, and they shouldn't be degraded for private interest. So some intelligent and crafty advocates and lawyers have started seeing how this relates to the climate crisis and saying maybe the atmosphere, maybe bodies of water, all of these different elements of the environment are being affected by the profit-making activities of the fossil fuel industry. Let's assert the government's responsibility to protect those resources and force them to implement policies and plans that would prevent private corporations from degrading them, because they belong to all of us. Now, related to that, but I would say maybe a little bit even more ambitious or a more foundational critique of fossil law is involved with rights of nature. That is essentially the idea that we should grant legal subjectivity, legal personhood, legal rights to non-humans, whether that's other mammalian species, or that could be ecosystems, that could be mountains, it could be rivers. Why not give them legal standing, given that they're so important to our society, and we have an ethical sense that they deserve to thrive in their own right? So there's a lot of ways people have thought about how to construct such a system, give human spokespersons the right to talk about the interests of nature. And one thing I really want to emphasize here, and as I hope I describe accurately in the book, is that rights of nature is an idea that's really coming from other countries. It's not most prominent in the United States. Indigenous communities are leading the fight for rights of nature, and in particular in Latin America, in countries like Ecuador and Bolivia, they've already constitutionalized or legislated rights of nature, and we're at the early phases, but we're already starting to see again how nature rights can give us better environmental protection, but can also give us a new and better sense of legal obligation and how we think about our relationship to non-human and to future generations.
7 years ago, I edited a book called Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, and Michael Ratner, one of the founders of Law and Disorder, contributed a chapter, and his chapter was entitled What I Would Do If I Was the Attorney General. And one of the things he said he would do was that he would recognize the rights of nature in the same way that Ecuador and Bolivia did. So that was the first time that I got an inkling of what it meant to have the rights of nature. And I was so very pleased to see that in your book, Beyond Fossil Law, that you write about that too, the rights of nature, a really profound and revolutionary concept.
Yeah, it is. And it's another example of why there is a growing intelligent thought about climate change, and why, in fact, there are actually some things that are being done that are helpful and right. And yet, not to throw a wet blanket on all of this, the fact remains that every year over the past number of years, the amount of greenhouse gases, methane gases that are being released into the atmosphere that are the culprit here because of human activity, get higher as opposed to lower, despite the fact that we know now more about what we should be doing and, more importantly, perhaps what we shouldn't be doing. And, of course, we know that when it comes to the property interest of corporations, they generally trump the health concerns of future generations and so forth. I guess my question, Ted, is so long as we have these large capitalist corporations who win in court more often than they lose, who despite what little measures may be taken, they continue to pollute the atmosphere more every year as a collective than the year before, can we hope to ever actually achieve what we need to achieve with respect to climate change, so long as those large capitalist corporations are allowed to function as they do today?
So I seriously doubt that we would ever design a market system with large multinational corporations that would not be inclined to continue profiting off of fossil fuels. So I do think we need to really remove them as the chief actors who control our environmental destiny. And we can look at this, again, at a few different levels. Most basically, fossil fuel industry has structural control of Congress. Those aren't my words. Those are actually the words of Brian Schaaf, the senator from Hawaii. They actually control our policy around climate change. But more deeply, even a system like environmental law in the United States, which has done a lot of good work in terms of conservation and environmental health, it essentially exists as a way to mitigate the impact of corporations on the environment, but not to fundamentally challenge how they operate. And again, there's just a foundational manner in which these corporations need to continue seeking cheap energy sources in order to ramp up production and keep producing profits. So long as that's the way we're designing our interaction with the environment, I don't think there's much hope for preventing climate catastrophe. So one of the tasks for legal activists and legal actors is not only to ramp up environmental protection, but to change the rules of the game so that it becomes illegal to conduct that sort of activity rather than legal, but maybe with some regulations or limits on how severe the outcomes might be.
Well, Ted Hamilton, unfortunately, we've come down to the end of our allotted time here. I wanted to remind our listeners that you've written the just-published book, Beyond Fossil Law, Climate Courts and the Fight for a Sustainable Future. It's a beautifully written book, an important book, and I urge people to go out and get it. You can get it from Orr Books, orrbooks.com. Ted, before we have to say goodbye, if listeners want to get active, what might they do? And secondly, how can listeners stay in touch with you and your organization?
I think everybody should go out and try to join their local climate justice groups. We need more people getting out into the streets and taking the kind of action that the valve turners did, getting directly involved in preventing the extraction use of fossil fuels. Find your local group. Look at umbrella organizations like the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance that are trying to connect people across continents and national boundaries. And then my organization, Climate Defense Project, you can check us out at climatedefenseproject.org. You can contact us, and we've got some great resources for activists on our website as well.
Well, Ted Hamilton, I mean, it's just been a pleasure to have you with us today. I've learned a lot. I suspect our audience has as well, and we really thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's a fantastic show.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
And welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Our website is www.thetaxcast.com. If you're on Twitter, we're on Twitter handle TheTaxCast. If you want to make sure you never miss a TaxCast, just email me on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll put you on the subscribers list. Okay, so this month on The TaxCast, oligarchs behaving badly, governments behaving badly. This time, the scandal goes all the way to Downing Street, the heart of the British government, and the UK Chancellor, the Finance Minister, and his wife's extraordinary wealth. We all knew she had enormous inherited wealth, £11.5 million a year in dividends from her stake in her father's IT business based in India. But it turns out she opted to minimise her taxes using an archaic status to do so. She's a non-dom. So, what is a non-dom? Non-dom status refers to a person who is not domiciled in the UK. That doesn't mean they don't live in the UK. It just means that if one of their parents was born overseas, they can choose to claim this status, which saves them lots of tax. The UK Finance Minister's wife could well be avoiding £2 to 5 million a year in taxes because of the non-dom status she's opted for. Unlike most UK residents, non-doms don't pay UK tax on their worldwide income and capital gains, if you've got any worldwide income. The outrage at even this Conservative Member of Parliament in this parliamentary committee hearing pretty much sums up the anger of voters. Bear in mind, it's his party's finance minister's wife, just as her husband is currently raising taxes on the poorest people, especially as they face a cost of living crisis.
I mean, it's extraordinary, frankly.
Absolutely.
And you wonder why people.
It's a policy issue.
Yeah, I know it's a policy issue, and it's nothing to do with you. You're just the bloke in charge. I realise that. But I mean, in all honesty, you're surprised that people think there's one set of rules for the rich people and one set of rules for someone else, when you've just told us that that's exactly what there is.
And not only that, but both the finance minister, the chancellor, and his wealthy wife pledged permanent residence to the United States as green card holders while he was Member of Parliament and Finance Minister. I mean, we can legitimately ask, do politicians and their families believe in the societies they serve or not? Are they a part of it all or not? So far in the UK, only 5 of the 22 cabinet ministers are willing to confirm publicly whether they or their families benefit either from offshore holdings or from non-dom status. Back in 2015, I interviewed the amazing award-winning journalist from Pakistan, Umar Chima. We spoke about his inspirational achievement in making Pakistan only the 4th country in the world to publish the tax returns of its parliamentarians. I'll put the link to that interview in the show notes. This is what he told me at the time.
Interestingly, a senior finance ministry official told me that when the government of Pakistan announced the decision to make tax data public, they got to hear from the UK authorities that now we will come under pressure for doing the same in UK. I don't know when they do, but one should hope for the best, and the Tax Justice Network must use the example of Pakistan for pressuring the authorities in London.
Britain today and many other nations are still light years away from following Pakistan's example and putting the tax affairs of their elected representatives into the spotlight. I'm going to speak with one of the co-authors of a new report which for the first time unmasks the kind of people who are using this archaic non-dom status in the UK. They released their report just as the scandal about the finance minister's wife broke. Happy timing to get major attention onto something fundamentally unjust. But first, I'm going to speak with economist John Christensen. Okay, John, so non-dom status is something we've spoken about quite a few times on the TaxCast, and as is so often the case with these things, this is yet another example of how oligarchs behave. And we can apply that term to all the super rich. It doesn't just apply to Russians. They just live in a parallel universe where taxation applied to ordinary people doesn't apply to them and borders don't apply to them. Now it looks like the UK finance minister's wife, the chancellor's wife, has pretty much damaged her husband's political career because there's a lot of anger from ordinary people about the hypocrisy of tax minimisation by the family of the man who's setting our tax policy in the UK and has done absolutely nothing to help citizens in the cost of living crisis they face. She's now said she'll pay tax voluntarily in the UK. And it's important to make clear that she can say, hand on heart, that she's paying all taxes that are due completely legally, partly through her non-dom status. But also, interestingly, she's got the payouts on her huge inherited wealth routed through the tax haven of Mauritius. So she's likely to be paying zero tax there. And this is very much what we call unearned income. So a thing that's so undertaxed compared to what we all work to earn.
Yep, so look, we've discussed the non-dom rule many times, and we've also campaigned for its abolition. But bear in mind the following. Firstly, domicile has nothing to do with citizenship. You can hold an Indian passport, as Miss Murphy does, but live and work in London and pay UK taxes on your income. Secondly, being non-domiciled is a personal choice. You actually need to apply to Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs to be deemed to be non-domiciled in the UK. And equally, if you want to pay taxes in the UK in the same way as the vast majority of ordinary people do, then you can give up your non-dom status and you can do this without in any way undermining your Indian citizenship. And thirdly, that when Miss Murthy's spokesperson claims, as they did, that she has been paying all the taxes she is legally liable to pay, this statement needs to be unbundled very carefully indeed, because it is almost certain that most people won't understand the implications of what is being said. Because most people are used to being taxed on a pay-as-you-earn basis, and they don't receive unearned income from wealth held in an offshore holding company. So in light of the scandal that blew up, especially after her husband went ahead with increasing the national insurance contribution rates, which apply to most workers, Ms. Murphy has reportedly chosen to give up her non-dom status and will henceforth be paying UK tax on all her worldwide income. But unfortunately for her and for her husband, the reputational harm caused when her non-dom status was revealed is probably irreversible, and her husband's long-held ambition to be Prime Minister of the United Kingdom has probably been holed below the waterline. That's because if there's something the wider public really hate, it's the notion that there's one rule for super rich people and another rule entirely for ordinary people.
Yeah, and especially while he was raising taxes on everybody else.
Yeah.
So the UK's kind of really archaic non-dom status has influenced other nations. I mean, Italy, where I am at the moment, they introduced something that was inspired by the UK. Just at the same time, political opposition in the UK did actually persuade the government to scale it back a bit. And I do mean a bit, because they put a 15-year time limit on it and they made it more expensive after a while. So the cost of £30,000 a year fee, which is over $37,500 a year to £60,000 a year, and that's about $75,000 a year. More than most of us earn in a full year, so it's obviously well worth it for these non-doms. And tax havens elsewhere also have all kinds of unjustifiable assorted advantages. And really, all of this means that we must redefine the principles that should govern us all equally, right?
Oh, absolutely, because, see, the non-dom rule and the equivalent rules in many other countries come out of a particular ideology, a tax haven ideology, and it's worth just a look at that ideology and understand why politicians think it's worthwhile targeting tax breaks at the super-rich people. The argument goes that super-rich people are super-mobile. They can choose to locate themselves anywhere, Monaco one month, Palm Beach the next. They can choose to locate their financial assets and their wealth anywhere, Cayman Island, Mauritius, wherever. So paying tax for the super-rich is entirely a voluntary matter. There's a perceptible public sense that the rules, especially the tax rules, are biased to the interests of the very wealthiest people in society. And the wider public, especially in Britain, but I think the same can be said in Italy and in France, are paying high levels of tax whilst receiving increasingly poor quality of public services. So the non-dom rule, as far as I'm concerned, epitomises this sense of fracture of the social contract and the gradual erosion of people's commitment to democracy. And that's why we need this whole new set of governing principles to re-establish some sense of a social contract here in Europe and elsewhere in the world where similar tax breaks have been given to the super rich.
Yeah, and what governments everywhere always say to justify these kinds of privileges for the very wealthy is it encourages investment. And I'm going to speak in a minute to the co-author of a really important report on non-dom status about how much that really is a load of nonsense. But when it comes to the term investment, that's a really, really tricky word, isn't it? Because actually, it's worthy of an entire tax cast in itself, which is something I've intended to do for a while.
Yeah, well, the word investment, as far as I'm concerned, is just a catch-all word used by lazy economists and politicians to confuse the public and obfuscate. As far as I'm concerned, much of what is termed investments, particularly inward investment, doesn't flow into new facilities or researching new technologies. Instead, it goes into acquiring or merging with existing businesses, often leading to job cuts and often consolidating the market power of major companies who might already have monopolistic powers in that market. So, yeah, absolutely. Let's go ahead. Let's have that addition of the tax cast. Let's discuss this matter because we need to bring pressure to bear on the economists and the national statisticians who provide the data on so-called investments, because we need to have a much better understanding of whether all these tax breaks to super-rich people are actually leading to real investment in new jobs and new ideas and new services, or are they actually helping just the super rich and everyone apart from the super rich find their situation being eroded by the lack of investment into new wealth creating activities.
Thanks, John. Economist John Christensen. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature, the UK's non-doms. Who are they? What do they do? And where do they live? What does it tell us about wealth and fairness? Now we have a new report just out. For the first time, the data on non-doms have been mined by a team of economists and data specialists. We now have a picture of the UK's non-doms. These are people who are paying a non-dom fee from £30,000 to £60,000 a year. That's more than most of us earn in an entire year. It helps us definitively answer the question, what is the point of non-dom status? Who does it serve? I'm speaking to Aaron Advani of the University of Warwick, one of the report's authors. So, hi Aaron, the most obvious question is, how do you get non-dom status?
You're non-dom just as a fact of your existence. So you either are or aren't a non-dom, and that just is a function of whether your permanent home is the UK or not the UK. So if you're born here, brought up here, through a British parent, and you expect to live here the rest of your life, you're a UK domiciled person. This is your permanent home. If, however, you come from another country and you intend potentially to go back there, then you would be a non-dom, and that will apply to, you know, many, many people. Then there's a separate question that's been coming up recently, which is about whether you are sort of a non-dom for tax purposes. And this is really a question about whether you choose to tick a box on the tax form that says, I wish to benefit from the remittance basis, which is a particular status that you get, if you're a non-dom. So if you're a UK dom, you don't have the option of that box. But if you're a non-dom, you can tick that box. And ticking that box says, I don't have to declare or pay tax on foreign investment income until such time as I bring that income into the UK. And if I never bring that income into the UK, then I will never pay tax on that income. And so that's kind of what all the recent debate has been about, has been there are people who tick a box on the tax form that gives them this particular benefit that says, if I keep my income from investments offshore, I won't have to be paying tax on it in the UK, and potentially I may not be paying tax on it anywhere in the world.
Right. It's the first time that the data on non-DOMs has been analysed like this in Britain. So I just wanted to ask you if you can describe the data that you've had access to, the data you used, and why you wanted to do this research.
So the data that we're using is from the UK Tax Authority. We go and sit in a secured room in the what's called the data lab in Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. And sitting in that secure room where we have no access to our phones or computers or anything else, of our own computers, we can use a secured set of computers that give us access to completely anonymized data. So I can't see anything about individuals in their personal capacities, their names or dates of birth or anything like that. But I can see anonymized data on all of the details you'd basically see on the tax form. So I can see what they filed as their level of income and what all of those like subcomponents on different boxes of the tax form are. So that's what we can see.
And why did you want to analyze this data?
Just at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a bit of a debate around wealth taxes and whether they would be the answer to what is going on in the pandemic and how we'd pay for it. And we had questions from journalists asking us, you know, what did we think? We felt like we ought to have an answer, and we didn't really have a good answer to that question. We didn't think we knew the answer. And so we set up the Wealth Tax Commission to go and study the kind of broader question about wealth taxes. And when we were doing that, you know, one of the areas that was most striking to us was we just really didn't have very good evidence on what goes on at the very top of the income distribution. And we have basically no information about wealth because the UK doesn't tax wealth directly, and so we don't store any information on this. And that obviously seems like a bit of a policy gap because you can't really answer questions like what would happen if you did this or did that to wealthy people if you don't have evidence on it. And as I say, these data are really nice because they are, you know, data for every single person in the tax system in the country. So it gives you the chance to kind of try and explore some of these big questions. And so we wanted to understand a bit more about the non-DOMs, but this first piece was really trying to understand just who are they? Like what kind of people are benefiting from the system? You know, their ages, their sex, where they come from, where they live in the UK, what are they doing in the UK? Those are the kind of questions we wanted to understand. What is the total benefit they're getting? How would they respond if we were to reform the system? And do they do brilliant stuff in terms of creating jobs, or do they have really negative effects on house prices? We don't know right now. We'd love to know that. And once we understand the answer to that kind of question, we can then think overall collectively about, you know, what would a sensible policy look like in this area.
Lots of really important questions. Incredible how little data we have in the UK on wealth. And here's some nuggets from the findings of this new report, the UK's non-DOMs. Who are they? What do they do? And where do they live? You'll find the link in the show notes. So here you go. 3 in 10 people who earned £5 million or more claimed non-DOM status in 2018. More than 1 in 5 top-earning bankers is a non-DOM. Most non-DOMs are men. Non-DOMs are highly represented in finance and city jobs. Most non-DOMs come from Western Europe, India and the United States. And since 2001, there's been a rapid rise in the number of non-DOMs from India, China and the former Soviet states. And most non-DOMs live in and around London in the most expensive districts. There's lots more. I really encourage you to read the report. So, Aaron, what surprised you most about your findings? I mean, for me, what surprised me a lot was the answer to one of your many great questions in the report, which was, are non-DOMs workers or rentiers? And it turns out around 80% of non-DOMs, as you say in the report, have got earnings from some kind of work or pension income as their main source of income. That means a lot of them seem to be engaged in substantial paid work. That is interesting. I also realise that there are caveats around that because the data you've looked at are based on reported income only, and it likely underestimates total income, given that one of the key benefits of non-DOM status is that they don't have to report or pay tax on their foreign source income unless it comes into the UK. So that's one of the unknowables. But yes, I kind of pictured someone not doing very much, sitting in their jacuzzi, quaffing champagne, but many are actually working.
Yes, that's one of my top three. And I think so the finding, as you say, is that 80% of them have, in the income that they declare, the main source of income is some kind of work or, in a small number of cases, pensions. And I guess that kind of is different to what people have in their mind of someone coming here, an oligarch or whatever, who lives here but lives off some big foreign investment income wealth. In the most part, it's not people who are coming here and sitting on their bum living off that foreign income. They may well also have lots of that foreign income, but they're also here and doing something here. They're in the labour market. They are working. The second thing sort of related to that work issue is, what are they doing? What kinds of work are they doing? The biggest group are in banking, which, maybe people aren't surprised. Finance is where there's lots of money in the UK, and we're not surprised these people are well off. But I think I was surprised by the scale of it. So 1 in 5 people working in a bank who are in the top 1%, basically, earning more than about £125,000, 1 in 5 of those are non-DOMs. And I think the third thing that I found really striking was when we did this kind of geographic picture of where people are, one of the areas that lit up was Manchester. So we thought, well, what's going on in Manchester? And you see that there's these very young people in Manchester who are in the sports industry, who are non-DOMs. And a youngish footballer is probably not what I would have first thought of as a major group of non-DOMs. And there aren't loads of them. They're not a huge number of them, as you kind of can imagine from the size of the teams that are out there. As I say, we don't know who any of the individuals are. We don't know what teams they play for, but given that they're in Manchester and they're non-DOMs and they're in sports, it's probably that they're footballers. But you can also see that they're very high incomes. Their kind of average incomes for those non-DOMs are about £2 million. So that's really high. And again, that's £2 million is the bit that's not including any foreign investment income they may have. So I think that was kind of my third really striking thing. It's just this group of people I hadn't really imagined who are out there.
That's interesting. And I mean, in terms of the typical profile of non-DOMs, I mean, we have to generalise quite a bit, obviously, but it's really interesting. It's a lot younger than I thought it might be. You say the age bracket has a tendency to being late 30s to early 40s, and not surprisingly to me, most of them are men. There's only under 35% of non-DOMs are women.
Yeah, so having started with, here are the ones that are not the typical ones, here are the ones I found surprising. I guess the thing we can say about the typical non-DOM is that the typical non-DOM is that kind of man you might picture. As you say, about a third of them are women, about two-thirds are men, which actually is a slightly higher ratio of women than you'd expect for just if you took generally high-income people. So there's slightly more women in that group. They're, middle-aged, in work, probably in some kind of city job, so most likely in finance, something like banking, but also in working consultancy, working in other kinds of support services that relate to banking, finance, business type things in the city. And they're living in the southeast. They're living in London or the surrounding areas.
And the actual proportion of people that we're talking about here, whilst it's a tiny proportion, I think you said 490,000 unique individuals who have claimed non-DOM status from 2001 to 2018 while being UK residents at some point. That total, that's 1% equivalent of all UK adults. But they do have a disproportionately large impact in terms of these tax-based decisions. And I'm assuming that they're tax-based decisions they made to claim non-DOM status with the tax authorities. And there's a lot of sort of unknowable questions that your research raises, right? What sort of things do we not know? I mean, in terms of the impact to the UK, we know they paid over 7 million in 2020 £7 million in income tax, capital gains, national insurance, and that doesn't seem very much to me.
Yes, I mean, I think there's big questions for us. Just how much tax would there be in a world in which every non-dom who was currently in the country had to stay in the country, and you could just work out how much tax sort of would they pay if they paid the same tax as everybody else. But the really hard bit is actually just to get a sense for what is the tax base, how much money is there out there that is potentially taxable if you were to change the tax system in some way. The question is just how will people respond? But that very first question, because we don't even ask what is the income that you're not having to pay tax on, what are the gains that you're not paying tax on, because we don't even ask that question, we don't even know what is that base. It's really hard to have an informed policy discussion, or, you know, if you were a minister and right now you were going to ask the tax authority to tell you, well, what is the effect of doing this reform? You know, how much money is out there? I think they could go and do some of the things that we're going to try and do, which is to do complicated ways to estimate what that would look like. But it would be much simpler if it was just on a form somewhere, like it is for most things, where you can say, okay, here's how much money there is out here, and this is what we can kind of get. And then having answered how much money's out there and answered how will people respond, the third question is, what are the other effects that it has on the economy? Is it the case that it will lead to slower growth, or will it help bring down house prices, or will it change how dynamic companies are? Will it change the number of patents we produce? All of those other economic questions we'd quite like to know the answer to beyond the tax benefit. And it's not clear, you know, whether there are those kind of big effects.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, the argument is that for the nation, it brings in investment, which you wouldn't otherwise get. But that word investment is such a tricky one, because if it's investment in something like the productive economy, or if it's investment in terms of speculative or in property or other investments that aren't necessarily going to bring much benefits to the UK, that's another kind of unknowable question. But I read that in 2019, the government says that non-doms invested over £1 million in the UK, which again doesn't sound like very much.
Well, I mean, I think the other thing that's worth remembering in the context of the non-dom policy is that what the policy does in its current form on remittance basis, which is this tax benefit you get, is it says, if you come to the UK, we'll give you a tax benefit, and that tax benefit is on overseas investment income. So if you have lots of wealth that's generating lots of income, as long as you promise to keep it overseas and not bring it into the UK, we will give you a tax break. So if what you were trying to do was to bring investment into the UK by bringing wealth into the UK and having people invest in, you know, productive stuff here, this is absolutely not the way to do it. This is encouraging people who have lots of wealth to come to the UK and to not bring their wealth to the UK. And if they were to bring their wealth to the UK, then they will not get this benefit. There are, you know, I should say at this point for the legally minded people who are listening, there is something called business investment relief. In principle, that does provide a way in which people could still retain some of the benefit, because it's clear that this is a completely mad system. But it's so hard to use business investment relief that when you look at the statistics, you can see that basically no one is using it. It's just too hard to use it, and nobody kind of tries. It's just easier to keep your money offshore. And so what we see is that we have a regime that explicitly encourages people not to bring their money onshore.
Right, which begs the question, what is the point?
Yeah, and I mean, I think this is a good point to also reflect on the fact that the non-dom regime shouldn't be thought of as something that was designed, in the sense that the remittance basis, which is the thing that lets you have delayed, to not pay tax on your overseas income, is a, you know, colonial era thing. It was invented in 1799, around the same time as the income tax. And it basically said, look, if you have income that you get from overseas, you know, in the old days, back in colonial times, you have something, you know, a sugar plantation in the Caribbean or something, you don't have to pay income tax on that income the moment it arises. That is the point at which that income exists. We'll wait until the point which you bring it onshore, because in those days, to trade that sugar or whatever else it was you were trading, you'd have to bring it into Liverpool or some other dock in the UK. You'd have to bring it onshore before you could then send it back out to somewhere else, to some other colony. And so it was just a deferral of tax. We wouldn't just not charge it to you yet. We'll charge it to you at the point that money comes onshore, when you have access to actually touch it. And in the off chance that, you know, the ship sinks or something, then you're never going to pay that tax because you never really got the income. So that, you know, there's some rationale to that. Then over time, there were loads of reforms that kind of narrowed the scope of doing that. And eventually, you know, much later, made it the case that not everyone could benefit from this ability to keep this money offshore. Only people who were non-DOMs could have this benefit. So originally the remittance basis, which is this overseas income isn't taxed at the point that it arises, it was taxed only when it comes onshore. that was available to everybody. Then that later got narrowed down to just people who are not domiciled in the UK. But also, over time, as we know the world has changed, it's no longer the case that this is a tax deferral policy. It's not the case that we're just deferring that tax till some later date when the money comes on shore. Now people can benefit from that money without ever bringing it on shore. And so it's no longer deferring the tax. It's now just saying you could get away with never paying that tax. And that doesn't seem like what it was originally intended to do in any sense. It's also just not the case that it's doing any specific thing that we would currently set down as a goal that policy has. Like, if you start from first principles and say, I have a goal for policy, which is to bring in brilliant, smart, bright people who can come and work in the UK, and to bring in people who have loads of money, who can bring it in and can invest in the UK, then this policy is not doing that, because it's both, in that second case, telling people don't bring that money into the UK, and in that first case, it's not clear that this is the best way you want to encourage those people to come into the UK. Because it's in fact saying to those people, come here, but make sure that in your hearts you keep in mind that you don't want to stay here forever. Because if you come here and you decide that you actually want to stay here and you like living here and this is where you think your permanent home is quite quickly, then you no longer benefit from this regime. So you better believe that your permanent home is some other country. Which again, you know, if you think these people are brilliant and are doing great stuff here, why discourage them in that way that says, you know, we hope that you are not making a permanent home in the UK. We hope you're just settling for a little while. It was not designed for these goals. If these are the goals you're trying to have, this policy is not achieving them.
No. I mean, it's completely illogical. One of many illogical colonial overhangs, which doesn't make any sense now, unless you're wealthy, powerful, and happy to take these unfair advantages. In terms of attracting brilliant people, I mean, in the case of the UK finance minister's wife, as far as I know, there's no entrepreneurial brilliance on her part. She just inherited a stake in her dad's IT business based in India. And the last time I checked, in Britain, only 5 of the 22 cabinet ministers are willing to confirm publicly whether they or their families benefit either from offshore holdings or from non-dom status. I mean, you surely think non-dom status should end?
Yeah, I do think that non-dom, the domicile as a concept doesn't have a place in the tax system, and there are lots of other things in the system that need fixing, and we happened to get really lucky this time that there was this big news story that you know, with the most ridiculous timing, broke right close to when we were trying to release our stuff. But more broadly, how does one get reform of these kinds of things on the agenda? Because they are niche, they are boring, they are technical. Most people don't know anything about them. Journalists mostly don't have any reason to think about them and are going to find it hard to sell to their editor that this should make an important news story. And so in that environment, how do you fix those things? But you know, there's all those other things that are out there that we need to make sure that people are thinking about. And that just because there's no news story about them right now, they don't get ignored for, you know, 10 years until there happens to be a news story and then they get dealt with. We need people to be thinking about them right now.
He's singing the song of the tax justice movement. But all this boring, technical, niche stuff, fair taxes, is the lifeblood of our nations. We've got to care about it. The political opposition in the UK has now proposed abolishing non-dom status, which is good news that finally this illogical perk of the very wealthy might be at the beginning of the end. And so many other perks need to go with it too, not least the secrecy that protects the rich from the fair taxes that we all contribute. Join me next month on the TaxCast for the results of the latest 2022 Tax Justice Network Financial Secrecy Index. And you can hear how badly your country ranks as a global secrecy offender. Thanks for listening. Bye for now. We'll be right back.